Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Matthias Dubke from Northwestern University. Matthias and I met at the European Economic Association's annual meetings in Milan in August 2008, where we spoke about his research on the emergence of women's rights and gender equality in England and the United States in the 19th and 20th centuries. He began by explaining how he got interested in this issue.
So I'm mostly a growth economist, and in economic growth recently there's been a lot of interest in evolution of institutions, in particular of political rights. So one of the broader facts is that not just women, but people in general got more rights in the course of development. So we have democratization, expansion of the franchise to larger and larger groups, which ultimately lead to kind of, you know, a state nowadays where we have democracy and equal rights in most of the rich countries of the world. But if you think about expansion of rights, the expansion of rights for women was much more dramatic overall than for people in general. So from a male perspective, men always had fairly developed civil rights, whereas only the political rights were missing. On the other hand, from a female perspective, married women, especially in common law countries such as the UK and the United States, until about 1800 had essentially no civil rights whatsoever. So you got married, and upon marriage, all rights that existed previously were merged into the marriage, and the husbands were the only ones who got to make any decisions. So married women did not have any rights over property, they could not keep their earnings, they were not able to pass any of their property to their children, they didn't have any rights at all over their children. If there was a breakup, for example, men would have full control, full custody of their children. So one motivation is that the expansion of rights for women was just so large compared to the average. But the second motivation is that much of the literature on the expansion of rights in general revolves around the topic of the threat of violence, that there might be some elite that's suppressing the landless masses, and that the only reason why the elite decides to share power with the masses is that they fear being overthrown by some kind of revolution. That's one of the theories that Doronza Mogler, for example, has emphasized. Now, when you think of the expansion of women's rights, that doesn't seem like a very credible theory. We don't really think of a large threat of the women rising up and raising arms and starting to shoot at all the men. So it seems to be an example where some other mechanism has to be at work. Now, that is, in our view, particularly true for the expansion of rights of women in the 19th century. From a modern perspective, we often think of franchise extensions, so the right to vote, female suffrage as the main breakthrough in the rights of women. But this actually, in the history of the expansion of rights, comes fairly late. So the expansion of the female suffrage is 1918, 1920 in the UK, in the United States, and comes even later in other industrialized countries. So that's essentially a 20th century event. But then many of the most significant changes in civil rights come earlier. So this is particularly true for married women. What you see is that in terms of marital property law, child custody law, and divorce law, all the major reforms actually occurred in the 19th century. So it's really the second half of the 19th century where we see all these major reforms. Now that may at first sight seem puzzling, because this was a time when women did not have any political rights at all. Now, once women are in parliament and can vote, it's not really entirely surprising that their rights get extended, because they are voters whose interests in some form will be at least taken into consideration. But this expansion of rights really happened at a time where all politicians were male, and everybody they were accountable to, all the voters, were male also. And still we see this quite amazing expansion of rights where married women had essentially no rights at all at the beginning of the century, and had almost equal rights, at least in the civil rights arena, by the end of the century.
So that's what you're trying to explain. You're trying to come up with some explanation of why men gave rights to women in this way.
But the key thing there is that it's a voluntary thing. You know, that it doesn't seem to be a forcing. It's not forced upon the men from the outside, but they're somehow on their own to decide to grant all these rights. Certainly with some campaigning on the sides of women, but no kind of, you know, direct influence on the policy making per se. So that's really what got us interested in this question.
So how do you go about thinking about this? How do you explain the fact that there is this voluntary giving up of power effectively to women?
Right. So far as the question was, you know, what really changed at that time in history? Because the initial situation of men being in charge, that lasted essentially from the beginning of times. You know, there's very little examples of matriarchy in history, so you can think of, you know, tenth of thousands of years of patriarchy, and then this very sudden switch. Now the question is, what changed? So more recently, people have thought a lot about the increase in female labor force participation, but looking at the data, we felt quickly that couldn't really be the story, because the expansion of rights mostly affected married women, and married women simply were not working in the 19th century. So the large expansion of female labor force participation for married women is really a post-World War II event for the most part in industrialized countries. So it couldn't really be that from our perspective, it had to be something else, and what that left was what happens inside the family. So we felt there had to be something about relations inside the family, you know, where women were essentially, you know, concentrating all the activities that had to explain the switch. And that kind of makes sense if you see what actually happened to families in the 19th century. Because in the same phase, the second half of the century in particular, you have a huge fertility decline where families go from having 6, 7, 8 children to having just 2 or 3. So the main phase of falling fertility is in just this era. And at the same time, you have the major expansion of education. So what we observe is a switch where at the beginning of the century, families were about producing lots of children, but mostly making them work. Whereas at the end of the century, you have families as really a status of the accumulation of human capital. So they have few children, but they invest a lot of resources into their children. So we thought that we should somehow link this switch to the role of families to the changing rights of women.
So how does that work exactly? What's the mechanism by which this would operate?
So then we set up a model where we have, you know, married couples doing the decisions, deciding on the allocation of consumption, for example, in the household, on labor supply, and also on the education of children and their fertility rate. And we try to figure out what different changes in the economic environment do to men's incentives to granting power to women. Now, we focus on men because they were in political control at the time, so we really want to get a situation where it's in the man's self-interest to share power with women. So the question is, why would they want to do that? Now, in our model, what actually arises is a trade-off between, from a man's perspective, the rights of his own wife versus the rights of other men's wives. In a man's own relationship, you know, if this man happens to love his wife, nobody's going to stop him from giving lots of resources to her or to listening to her suggestions of the family should be run. But there's nothing to be gained from the government forcing some choice on him. So our self-interested men, you know, they are self-interested in our model, will not really want the government to interfere in their own relationship. But at the same time, in our model, men do have preferences over other men's relationships, over other marriages in the economy. So one particular example of that that's important in the theory is the marriages of their daughters. Our couples have children, both sons and daughters, and men care about the outcomes in those relationships because they care directly about their daughters, but also, for example, because they care about their grandchildren. So one channel that plays actually quite an important role in the theory is that men care about the entire dynasty, so they care in particular about the education of their grandchildren. Now, one conflict that's going to arise is about how much resources the daughters' families are going to invest in education versus consumption. Ultimately what we're going to get at is that by granting more power to women, men are going to be able to get better education for their grandchildren, also other people in the economy, and that is something they find attractive.
So what data can you look at to try and confirm or deny whether this view, this model of the mechanisms holds water?
So what we've done so far is, well, the first thing you can look at is the timing of the changes. So we observe in the data that the expansion of rights falls essentially into the main phase of fertility decline and the main phase of expansion of education. So the fertility going down, education going up, and women's rights being expanded, that all happens at the same time. You can also look to some extent across state variation, for example, in the US, so which states were the first to expand rights, although there's, you know, some special factors that might make that a little bit tenuous. Another thing you can do is just look directly at the political debate that was going on. So we have records from the parliamentary debates, we also have records from newspaper editorials, for example, where you can really observe what kind of arguments were made in favor of expanding women's rights and which arguments were made against. And one thing we observe there is that kind of the key point of our theory that's really concern for the children that drives this change. So that men expanded power to women because they wanted to get better education for children, that this motive shows up more and more as the century progresses. this idea that giving power to women would be beneficial for children doesn't really come up at all at the beginning of the 19th century. That was actually faced with this whole idea of motherhood, you know, of mothers mostly being in charge of nurturing their children, wasn't actually that developed yet. To some extent, that was a 19th century development. As you then go along the century, that becomes more and more prevalent. So every time we see a discussion of women's rights, the needs and education of children are discussed in the same context. So, for example, when they were expanding marital property law in the 1870s, there was a lot of concern that if you didn't have some protection for the wives, there might be at least some irresponsible man who would take all the income from the household and take it to the bar at the corner to buy more liquor rather than investing in the education and welfare of the children. So one motivation was to give women the legal means to protect their own children from irresponsible fathers. In our view, the reason this became so important is that education became more important. So we think of the underlying change as really a technological change that increased the role of human capital in the economy. And it was really this increased demand for human capital that focused families on education and human capital, and that in turn, in our view, was what triggered the expansion of women's rights.
What kind of implications could you draw from this research for developing countries where, of course, there's lots of concerns about greater gender equality and encouraging much more education for girls and women more generally?
Right. So one kind of obvious conclusion is the close link between education and women's rights. So in what's true in our model, if the return to education goes up, so if in some sense the incentives on a private level for individual couples to invest in education, if those increase, then there will also be more pressure and more support for increasing women's rights. So you could argue that improving access to schools, subsidizing schools, for example, especially for girls, would be one policy measure that as a side effect would also have some impact on the expansion of women's rights. But maybe a more interesting aspect to look at, which we plan to do in future research, is to look at different cultural differences in marriage institutions. So one thing that plays some role in our analysis, for example, is what we call the marriage market externality. In most countries, well, hopefully in all countries, children tend to marry not their own brothers and sisters, but somebody else. Which means that some of the education that I give to my own children will benefit somebody else, namely the spouse and the parents of the spouses of my own children. So this externality can lead to underinvestment in education, and in our model, giving rights to women is one way of fixing this externality. But different institutions might have different ways of dealing with this externality. So, for example, in Western countries, we know are very strongly a solid of mating, where highly educated children tend to mate with highly educated spouses, which to some extent internalizes this difficulty. You know, you get some by educating your own children more, you will get a better spouse for them, essentially. Other cultures have different institutions, as bride prices or dowries, and in some cases even polygamy, where these trade-offs are internalized or not internalized in very different ways. So one thing we want to do is to analyze how the marriage institutions in different countries feedback and incentives for granting rights to women.
But the basic story is that growth is good for women's rights, and women's rights are good for men if they care about the future generations.
That's right. That's the basic story. Return to education, so demand for human capital is the driving force. And once that's there, then men become interested on their own in the welfare of women. That's certainly what we think happened in the Western countries. I think the evidence for this is actually quite supportive, at least for this historical period. And we still have to take to developing countries and see how we can explain some of the differences that we see in the adoption of women's rights.
Matthias Ducker, many thanks.
Thank you.